Hey, it's the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and with me as always is Steve. How are you doing?
John, I'm well. How are you?
Good, good. And, I'm really happy this week where we have a great guest, especially if you're worried about keeping safe, keeping yourself safe, your company safe, maybe your country safe. I mean, it's all for grabs these days. We're lucky to have Dr. Eric Cole, the founder and CEO of Secure Anchor, and the author of the just released book called Cyber Crisis. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Great having you on. I look forward to this. Right off the bat, there's some chatter that the Facebook outage, which affected billions, of course, could have been the result of a cyber attack. What are you thinking on that?
To me, nobody ever wants to use the word cyber attack. It's like the boogeyman. It's like it freaks people out and gets everyone really, really scared. So it's much better to go in and say, oh, our servers went down or our systems were unreliable. And I don't know about you. I just rolled my eyes going, okay, you want to tell me that an organization like Facebook doesn't have redundancy, they don't have backups, they don't have generators, they don't have failovers, and that their infrastructure is so poorly redundant that it would actually go down for 6 hours. And I'll tell you, if you're believing that, I got some bridges I can sell you and some great cyber currency out there. But I'm just not buying it. To me, it smells like a cyber attack. It smells like that there was a bigger problem going on. But I just don't think companies want to have that exposure reliability. So they just come up with an excuse.
Yeah, it was so widespread. I mean, just all of their properties, like the whole company pretty much was down. It seems like one mistake somewhere wouldn't do that. But you think maybe they didn't pay off some ransom or something?
Usually what happens with these really, really large companies is they actually do what we call pretest ransomware. And essentially what they'll do is they'll take your site down for a couple of hours. They'll let it come back up and they'll say, okay, if you don't give us whatever the $15, $20 million, we're going to keep doing this and keep doing it in an unpredictable manner. So it's not like with large scale data set, like if you have a database or a bank or a hospital and they encrypt all your data, you're going to pay a ransom to get it back, to get up and operational. But if you look at an asset like Facebook, where it's all public information, like what are they going to really hold ransom? It's more of an availability than data itself. So what they really do is just test out the system, basically say, hey, we're here, we can get in. And it's almost like the mafia in the New York City in the 70s, where you almost have to pay protection fees. Otherwise, they're just going to come in and mess up your store or take down your company.
Basically, oh, that's a nice platform you got there. Shame if something were to happen to it. But you know, of course, we're the FinTech Newscast, so we cover the financing space. There seems to be sort of a symbiosis between cryptocurrencies, especially Bitcoin, and the whole cyber criminal space. Is there anything we can do on a policy level to address what seems to be sort of a rising tide of cybercrime?
The benefit and value of cyber currency is also the value and benefit for the adversary or the drawback for us, because if you're going to commit a cybercrime, you basically want a way for somebody to give you untraceable money. Paying with a bank transfer, very dangerous. Paying with a credit card, you could cancel it. Paying with debit cards. So the problem we had before cybercurrency was ransomware always existed, but there was no easy, straightforward way for the attackers to be able to get payment. I love cybercurrency. I think it's great. But from a pure cybersecurity perspective, the problem is it also makes it way too easy for cyber criminal groups to commercialize this activity and basically take money from people that's pretty much untraceable.
Yeah, that's essentially one of the key selling points of cryptocurrency, is the fact that it is untraceable. But it sounds like there's nothing we could do on a policy level, right? At least without fundamentally changing one of the basic tenets of cryptocurrency.
If we go in and basically change the entire face of cybercurrency and make all cybercurrency fully regulated and fully traceable, which basically defeats the point of cybercurrency, but if we basically make cybercurrency not cybercurrency and a government regulated currency, then that could start lead to traceability and other avenues. But to me, the genie is sort of out of the bottle because they'll come up with other ones. It's so easy and straightforward to go in and create a new cyber currency that even if the government tries to regulate, there'll be underground currencies just like the dark web and other methods that the cyber criminals will still use.
Speaking of the dark web, you spent some time in your book discussing how it's used for cybercrime, but can you explain at a foundational level what the dark web actually is and how it's being used?
It's essentially take Facebook, Amazon, E-Trade, all of those things, and it's separate servers, separate sites that you go to, except it's all illegal activity. So if you want to go in and trade PII, social security numbers, you want to go in and commit crimes, do money laundering, anything like that, it's essentially a bunch of servers that operate and function just like the regular internet does, except the sole purpose is for cybercrime. And the trick there is it's just like going into gangs. There's levels of access. So if you want to join a really, really bad gang, you have to kill somebody. That basically proves you're not an undercover cop, and it shows that you're loyal to the greater cause. Well, the dark web is very similar. It has different levels of access, and where the really heinous activity occurs, you have to go in and basically commit major crimes to be able to prove that you're not undercover and prove that you're one of them to be able to get access to that information and that data. So what a lot of cybersecurity companies do is we'll team up with various levels of criminal activity to be able to get access so they could search on our behalf to be able to see what is going on so we can have an early warning system for our customers. Because I would say probably at least 80, if not 90% of most large-scale attacks and or targeted attacks are discussed and data is exchanged on the dark web before the attack actually occurs. So if you have the right access levels or contacts, that could be a very, very good early warning system.
Speaking of early warning, should we, as a government, as a country, essentially mandate that private companies place more emphasis than they do now on cybersecurity? Because it seems like it's the responses can vary from basically meh to a full-fledged response and, you know, pleas to fix their issue. But it seems like there's no regulation body looking at how we address cyber on a private sector level.
I definitely think that the time has come and gone that we need to make cybersecurity a regulated industry. When we had the Colonial Pipeline attack several months ago, to me, that should have been the Enron moment in cybersecurity. And what I mean by that is we know when Enron happened, the government basically said, okay, publicly traded companies are not good boys and girls, and we need to regulate them. Well, when Colonial Pipeline happened, that was a preventable attack. Most of the attacks we have seen over the last 12 to 18 months are not because the adversary is very sophisticated. That's what big tech wants you to believe, because it lets them off the hook for having lax security. But the reality is they're all preventable, and companies are just making silly mistakes and not fixing the known vulnerabilities. And that's why these attacks keep happening. So I think it is definitely time when we need to start regulating cybersecurity.
Yeah, actually, going back to the dark web, you're talking about people discussing crimes on there. Is that true just internationally? Like you would see Iranian or North Korean or Russian, or would that be just certain countries? Because I don't... Or is it a different Russian-speaking part of the dark web, or North Korean part that they use those private servers, like you were saying, but they all operate kind of in a similar way, or do they have a different system? Or maybe in Russia's case, they just talk to their boss in the government. That's a little swipe at the Russians.
Yeah, so on the dark web, I mean, there are definitely some areas that are dedicated to certain types of crimes. But for the most part, these cyber criminals and the folks on the dark web really view the world that it's one big world. There's really no countries. So when you're going in and launching attacks, other than making sure you're in a country that it's not illegal and that doesn't have extradition treaties with the country you're breaking into. Other than that, after that, basically, it's boundaryless. So when you go in the dark web, you'll see people, whether it's Venezuela, US, Russia, or others, basically all going in and feeding information. The other thing that's really interesting that's not talked about a lot is a lot of these Russian hacking groups actually have people within the United States and sometimes within the company that nobody ever knows about that actually feeds them information. And they basically get a percent of the attack for feeding some of that data or information. Because just think about with some of these attack vectors, how did the adversary know or how did the Russians know that this server at this moment had this vulnerability, missing this patch? Yes, there is scanning tools out there. But when you look at the breadth and depth of the internet and the number of servers that are out there, to me, I'm not a fan of coincidences. And to me, some of these attacks are just too targeted and focused where they know exactly what to do and where to go. So to me, there's a lot of people that are feeding these Russian or Chinese hackers information.
Wow, I'd actually never thought of the insider threat. Have any of these cases been actually prosecuted publicly, or are any of those records open?
Not that have actually been fully prosecuted, because the problem is it's so difficult to prove. Like if I go home at night and I connect to the dark web from my own personal computer and I connect with some Russian hackers and I tell them about a new server or IP address that my company just put up, there's probably 50 or 60 people that know that. And once again, there's not enough data or information for law enforcement to be able to actually get warrants or anything like that. So there's a lot of suspicion when I talk to my clients and I talk with executives where they're like, yeah, we're pretty sure that somebody leaked something, but there's no way to pinpoint or determine who it was or what they did.
Yikes, that's kind of scary. You know, you don't, and so people are getting away with this. So maybe if I pull up in a new Ferrari and I, I was just from Bitcoin, from trading gains, but there's no way to prove and convict that. And yeah, I haven't seen that in the news where they've prosecuted somebody on the inside.
Yeah, I think here, at least here in Silicon Valley, a lot of what you see more frequently is essentially state-sponsored IP theft or corporate espionage, but not as much cyber crime facilitation from the inside.
Yeah, that's terrible. And there's no way around this then.
Well, the real answer is companies need to just do a better job of protecting and securing their assets. If you look at almost all of the major attacks we've seen over the last 12 to 18 months, it's basically because you had servers that were missing patches that contained critical data that wasn't properly encrypted. So if companies just kept their systems up to date, they didn't store any critical data on servers that were accessible from the internet. And when they encrypted data on internal servers, they kept the keys on a separate server. A lot of these attacks would go away very, very quickly. So to me, you can sit there and blame and point fingers, which these people shouldn't be doing that. But on the other hand, companies need to step up and start doing a better job of the security, because a lot of it's just very, very sloppy. And as I mentioned earlier, is very, very preventable.
Oh, I can relate. Speaking of preventable, this month is Cybersecurity Awareness Month in my company. And so, you know, we go through all the slides where we click through them, understand, you know, what a phishing attack looks like and so on and so forth. But is there anything we can do either in our personal lives or as employees that can help address some of the issues that we see with cybercrime? So one data point that I saw recently is that something like 80% of all cybercrimes can be attributed to human error.
Absolutely. I want to give a caveat here because I know some of my friends who have these companies are going to get mad at me. So I do believe that awareness training is important. I do believe that awareness does have its place in cybersecurity. I do believe it's important to train employees. However, I think we put way too much on the employees doing the right thing. I think we go, we sit there and say, oh, we have awareness training. We do some phishing campaigns. We're good. We're off to the races. But you just have to remember human nature means they're going to make mistakes. My favorite example is back in February of this year, I did an experiment. I went out to my clients of various technology fields and I asked for 50 volunteers. And I put those 50 people through 30 minutes of awareness training, where I told them everything they need to know about cybersecurity, the dangers, the issues. And I finished up my 30 minutes of awareness training with a capstone talking about how basically COVID phishing scams work, where if you get an email that says a coworker's been infected with COVID, click here, don't click on it, it's a scam. I went through all of that. 120 minutes, 2 hours later, I sent that exact phishing scam to those 50 people that just completed the awareness training. And you want to guess how many of them clicked on the link? 42 out of 50.
Oh,
so,
my God.
So it, to me, when you're getting into the high-end attacks, awareness doesn't work. What I do is we have to design solutions. This is what I do at my company. This is what I tell all my non-technical friends. Use two devices. I have a Windows device that I use for working on reports, working on analysis, putting together slides. I then have an iPad that I only use for surfing the web and checking email, nothing else. Now, by having two separate computers, most of the attacks out there today target Windows, not because it's more vulnerable, but because of the large install base. So if I'm checking email and surfing the web on an iPad, the probability of the malware working is very low. And even if somebody does write malware for an iPad, I do nothing but check email. So if my iPad gets infected, I just re-image it. And in 40 minutes, I'm back off to the races again. So to me, we need to get away from this idea in cyber where we tell it's the user's fault, it's the user's fault. And we need to engineer solutions that protect and secure them and their data.
That's crazy. Yeah. Right after you did the training. Yeah. Yeah. I bet you did this at the company I work at. But, you know, one thing we Steve and I have kind of batted back and forth is how effective VPNs are at protecting your data. And I don't know if it depends on the VPN that you use or other factors. Is that, does that, what kind of protection does that give you?
So VPNs can mean a lot of things to a lot of people. So let me define what I sort of mean by VPN, and then we can adjust it. A VPN is a virtual private network, and it's essentially a piece of software you run on your computer. So whenever you're transferring data from your computer out to systems or servers on the internet, it's fully encrypted. And to me, VPNs are great if you're doing untrusted wireless. So if you're going to a local coffee shop or an airport or anywhere or a hotel where there's public wireless, highly recommend VPNs because it makes sure your data is encrypted, protected, nobody intercepts it. Same thing with cell phones. A lot of people will go in and connect their cell phone to a wireless network and they don't realize that most of the data is unencrypted. So VPNs on cellular devices are also very, very good for any wireless. However, you also have to remember that VPNs can be used to bypass security. Like a lot of companies are going in and blocking countries. Like if you're in the US, you can block IP addresses from Russia or China. Well, if I'm in Russia and I have a VPN, I could basically pop off in New York and look like I'm coming from the US and then bypass your security controls. So VPNs do have good measures to protect against open wireless, but they also can be utilized to bypass security filtering.
Right, right. Yeah, I've heard when I was traveling before, a lot of people are using a VPN in whatever country they're in to say that they're, to look like they're in the US so they can still watch their Netflix shows and and all that stuff. Yeah. And for a lot of other reasons. Yeah.
I'm going to see if I can get a freebie here. So you've actually advised both the Obama administration and the Obama family as well. What advice did you give them on device protection?
So absolutely. When we're talking about mobile devices, smartphones, tablets, or things like that. What it really comes down to is you got to be really careful and really smart about the apps that you download. Because if I take an out-of-the-box smartphone, and Android has gotten a lot better over the years, whether it's Android or iPhone or any other variation that we have out there, out of the box, those devices are pretty secure. They're pretty locked down. The problem is what I think is the most dangerous word on the English planet. I cannot stand the F word. To me, the F word causes more problems, more issues, and more security exposure points. And of course, you know what I'm talking about when I say the F word, right? Free, right? Not what you were thinking, right? But free. Free is one of the most dangerous things on the planet. Most people don't realize the free apps that are available from the Android or the Apple store. In order for them to work, you have to allow them to access your mic, access your camera, access your pictures, and access your device. And the scary part is the first time you run it, it's going to ask you, can we access your camera, phone, blah, blah. And you're so eager to use this app. You go, yes, 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 yes. And then it never has to ask you again. And here's the worst part. If it asks you once, it meets all the requirements and can be in the Apple store. So our phones are spying on us. And it's because all of the apps that you have installed on those devices that are causing all those problems. So my big thing is if you need an app, pay for it. Go under security settings under your phone and look under what apps are accessing your location, your camera, your pictures, and your microphone, and make sure they're absolutely required. But by removing and deleting apps is really the best way to secure or protect your device.
Yeah, it's really interesting. All the clever tricks they have for, I've seen there's a scam where you get a text on your phone for a code, and then the person that's, maybe they have your ID and password to get around this 2FA protection, they'll call you and ask for that code saying that they're from AT&T or, you know, the bank or whatever. And then they'll get that code from you, and then they can enter it and get into your account. Do you have any good examples or stories of some really elaborate ruses that these criminals have used?
If you'll give me leeway on elaborate, because unfortunately most of the attacks aren't super elaborate, but they're super, super effective. The one we're seeing a lot of, and I'm brought in on probably 5 or 6 of these cases a week now, is with the housing market being on a boom where everybody is buying real estate, everyone's selling houses and buying houses. And you know, when you're buying and selling a house, it's a high stress environment. So what these cyber criminals will do is all closings are public. So they'll go in and they'll say, oh, here's a $1.5 million home that's being closed on in a week, and it's a cash deal, which means the people buying it either through loans or direct have the cash, and they'll go in and break into the closing company's mail server, because these are usually smaller companies that are running their own mail server, not very secure. They'll break into their mail server, and 2 to 3 days before closing, they'll send an email that is legitimately from the closing agent. So everything looks perfect because it's from the mail server. And they'll say, listen, this happens quite often, but the seller of the house wants to change the banking account information. Can you please go in within the next 12 hours and transfer the $1.5 million to this bank account? We would need to verify it at least 24 hours. Otherwise, the closing is going to be delayed. Now, some people just blindly trust that, but most people will forward the email to the actual agent saying, hey, is this legit? Is this valid? Am I supposed to do this? Well, because the cyber criminal owns the mail server, they'll reply back, absolutely, this is quite, happens with quite frequency. You can even stop by the office if you want to talk to me, but please go ahead and take care of this right away.
These
people go and transfer their life savings. They show up to closing 2 days later, and we all know how the story ends. So we see these types of things happening all the time because people think email is a valid, authenticated method of communication, and it's not. So in those cases, you can't trust email. You need to do out-of-band verification. Go by the closing office. Stop and talk to them. There's still cases where getting it in writing with a wet signature has a lot of value and protection. So you just got to recognize the tech out there is very powerful, but very dangerous.
Oh, yeah. We've heard about that kind of scam before, right, Steve? With some of our fintech mortgage companies that automate this. But I didn't know I thought they were just dummying up an email. I didn't know they were breaking into the actual email server.
Yeah, that's certainly a whole new level of devious. You mentioned in your book that companies should really adhere to the three core tenets of cybersecurity. What are they?
So to me, the first thing I always go in is we have to understand the laws. Like there's a law of gravity. Whether you believe in the law of gravity or not, if you walk off a 10-story building, you're going to meet gravity. So the first thing we got to understand is there's the law of cybersecurity. And the law of cybersecurity is quite simple. Whenever you add functionality, you decrease security. Whenever you add functionality, you increase risk. You just have to recognize that. So the problem with most organizations is they believe that they can be 100% secure. Fallacy. The only way you could be 100% secure is with zero functionality. I joke, if you really want to be 100% secure, then move to Pennsylvania, become Amish, because the last time I checked, you can't hack a candle or a horse and buggy. But if you got tech and you got functionality, you do not have 100% security. So one of the things we always train our clients is instead of asking one question, which is what everyone does today, when they're going to make a business decision, they ask, what is the value or benefit? And is there a value or benefit? They do it. However, what I train our clients to do is ask additional questions. What is the value or benefit? What is the risk or exposure? And is the benefit worth the risk? And then and only then can you make a good, informed decision. And a great example of that is with the Colonial Pipeline hack. I cannot believe for a second that the executives at Colonial sat there and said, okay, we're going to take outdated servers with known vulnerabilities that have a 99% chance of getting broken into within 5 hours, and we're going to put that directly on the internet and put our entire pipeline at risk. How many people say they're in favor of that, right? I cannot imagine.
It was cheaper.
Exactly. I cannot imagine for a second that was the discussion. Instead, John, you're spot on. Basically, somebody came in and said, it's cheaper, quicker, better if we do this. They said, okay, increase in functionality. And they never asked the second question of what is the risk or exposure. And if they would have asked that simple second question, that whole pipeline hack could have been avoided.
It's always about the trade-off, right? Speaking of functionality, we've all sort of gotten accustomed over the past year and a half to basically working from home and accessing secure networks via VPN. How has COVID-19 and the whole work from home thing affected attack surfaces in the cybersecurity space for corporates?
Yeah, so essentially we went from a very robust architecture where when you're in the office, you're very secure. And when you're home, you're not very secure. And one of my favorite questions I love asking people, I just asked one of my friends who is the CIO for a large bank in New York City. And I said, hey, Pete, how many new offices did you open in 2020? And he looked at me like, Eric, you crazy? He goes, we shut down 7 of our main offices, and we decreased our office space. We didn't open up any new offices. We shut down offices. And I said, how many people are now working from home that previously weren't? And he said, well, about 11,000. I said, so Pete, you opened up 11,000 new offices in 2020. And it was sort of like, oh yeah, I guess we did. However, when they normally open up offices, they make sure there's security and there's checks and there's validation. Now in 2020, he opened up 11,000 offices within 24 hours with no security checks, no firewalls, no validation. So it greatly increased the attack surface, greatly increased the exposure. However, you don't hear about it on the news because the news isn't going to cover when Steve or John's system gets compromised and $80,000 gets taken from their bank account. Now, if you're Steve or John, you're going to be very upset with that, right? But it's not going to make the news. It's not like Colonial. So to me, it's given this fallacy where a lot of people that I talk to go, Eric, I watch the news every night and there's maybe a cybersecurity attack every 6 or 9 months. It's not a problem. It's not something I have to worry about. And I go, wrong. You're being targeted on a regular basis. You just don't know it because it's small. You're not looking and it's not covered on the media channels. So yes, we've seen a huge shift where prior to COVID, it was all about going after the big targets, big companies. And now with COVID, it's all about going after the individuals at home. But instead of breaking into one server and stealing a million records, you break into a million individuals, stealing one record from each.
So you've been very busy. You're mentioning that you're getting called up all the time for on these breaches. And how much has that turned into more being more proactive rather than reacting?
So the main premise of my company, Secure Anchor, is really proactive security. To me, if you do cybersecurity correctly, you should be able to detect attacks in a timely manner and minimize and control damage. You should never have a 100 million record breach and you should never have a Colonial Pipeline if you have the proper security and visibility. So we encourage clients to hire us before a breach. But I think we all know how this story ends. What's the number one reason why somebody installs an alarm system in their home? Yeah, somebody they know gets robbed. So yeah. Many of our clients typically are after they had a breach. They're like, okay, Eric, clearly the previous security companies we work with didn't do what they were supposed to. So can you help us out? So yes, we've been real busy coming in and helping. The big shift though is I used to travel internationally 90% of the time. And a lot of it was really on-site and on-prem. And we had to switch very quickly. And I'm glad we did because it's opened up a whole new opportunity where now we're going in with a lot of our clients and being able to do all the work remotely. And really now we have a lot of security architectures and blueprints for utilizing public cloud, private cloud, and hybrid, because with COVID, that's really your best option. And many companies move to the cloud very abruptly without thinking about security. And now by hiring us, we have reference architecture models you can lay right on top of that and actually secure it and lock it down pretty quickly.
Has anyone ever contacted people saying that they were you? Saying that I'm Dr. Eric Cole, cybersecurity expert, and then trying to get in on your credibility?
Funny example is the only case I do know about it was with my son at college. Somebody called them up and said, hey, it's your dad. Listen, I was traveling and my credit card didn't work. Could you give me the credit card that we gave you for school and blah, blah, blah. Luckily, my son was about to give it to him. And he was like, wait a second. My dad is a security guy. So he texts me when this person's on the phone and I'm like, it's not me. I said, but dude, let's mess with him. I said, tell him to hold on a second and actually bridge me into the conference. So he bridges me in and then my son's going and I'm like, yeah. And I'm wondering who is this again? And they said, oh, this is Jack's dad. I'm like, well, that's funny because just so you know, we kept you on the line for 90 seconds. So we did a full trace. This is Jack's real dad. Make sure you answer the door when the FBI knocks. And like they started screaming and cursing at us and hung up the phone. So we had a little fun with them, but that's the only one I know of, but I'm sure others might have tried that, but.
Yeah. So your company hasn't been a target. Do they target security companies just as like a revenge or just to show that they can do what they want?
I mean, they used to, like when you had the old school style, and I'm sure it happens here and there, where just for sort of embarrassment or to try to make a point or to sort of cause issues for that company, like for competitive advantages, you see a little of that. But most of what we're seeing today is the commercialization of cybercrime, and it's all about money. So these cyber criminals, they would much rather spend 30 hours and make a couple million dollars than spend 30 hours taking down a security company and embarrassing them. I mean, it still does happen, but I find that most of the attacks out to today are much more monetarily driven.
We've
been seeing that. It's the reporting about how it's such a business now. Like you were saying, someone will have a target. They'll have some tools that they can essentially lease, and it gets run by like a hacking as a service model. So it is huge industry.
Yeah, it's certainly mostly, I would assume, driven by money and profit rather than spite. Although, funny story, I recall maybe 10 years ago, the CEO of a company called LifeLock, which would offer services to lock down your social security number. He had his own number plastered all over billboards, you know, all across town and on the internet and whatever. And his own stuff was hacked as well. So if he's not safe, nobody is.
Yeah, the LifeLock, I mean, it's a good service depending on what you're looking for. But to me, like when the CEO did that and he's like putting it, I'm like, that's like jumping out of an airplane without a parachute claiming you're Superman. I'm like, it's just not a smart thing to do, man. I'm like, dude, what are you thinking?
Yeah, he's just asking for it. Well, hopefully nobody does break into your account. We're not challenging anybody.
But, yeah, I was gonna say, let's take the conversation in a different direction.
Let's take it somewhere else. Yeah. How has the book tour gone?
It's been very virtual. I haven't done any in-person book signings because things are still weird there. But I will tell you, it's sort of funny how things work out. I wrote the book. I don't know if you're familiar with the general publishing industry, but when you do like a New York City publisher, it takes about 10 months from when you finish writing the book for them to actually publish it. So I finished this book around May of 2020, when I was sort of like, okay, based on everything I see and what's going on, we are going to be in the midst of a cyber crisis by June 1. That was the release of my book. And then we start 2021 and it's like February and March and April, and like things are really quiet. And I'm like, oh, I'm getting a little scared here. So it's like, it's mid-May and we're selling okay. We're selling pretty good, but not great. And I remember talking to one of my friends the first week in May going, I tell you, not that I promote it or push it, but it would be nice if there was a really big hack that happened right now or a big exposure. And then, of course, we know mid-May was Colonial, all those. And essentially within 72 hours, I did 36 interviews and we almost tripled the sale of my book within that week. So I want to try to find out the address of the Russian hackers and send them a nice thank you basket, because it did definitely help the sale of the book.
Yeah, we see that sometimes, right? Where the book comes out just when something similar happens, and just some crazy, weird, lucky timing.
The funniest part of that story is, and you show you how my friends think of me, is the Colonial hack broke Friday night. And I go to bed pretty early because I get up early, and I wake up Saturday morning and I had at least 23 texts from my friends going, dude, did you hack Colonial to promote the sale of your book? I'm like, yeah, because that's what I'm going to do. Commit a major crime to sell my book. But it was funny how many people were like, dude, how did that work out? Such a coincidence. So,
Yeah. That's well, we know you're never going to have a shortage of business. That's for sure. And unfortunately, there's never going to be a shortage of these stories coming out and these hacks coming and hitting these big companies. So with all that, we wish you the best of luck and thank you for some interesting stories and some good advice.
My pleasure. And thank you again for having me on the show.
Yeah, great. That's Dr. Eric Cole, the founder and CEO of Secure Anchor Consulting. And as you heard, the author of Cyber Crisis. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in fintech news. And thank you for listening.